This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. When police officers arrive on the scene of a potentially violent situation, they're expected to attempt to de-escalate whatever it is that's going on. Turns out a lot of training goes in to handle those scenarios. Joining us now to talk about this is Sergeant Ward Smith. He's with the Firearms Training Section of the Kansas City Police Department. Sergeant Smith, thanks for taking some time. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You know, first of all, tell us a little bit about what you do with the Kansas City Police Department in the Firearms Training Division.
So, to reflect the actual duties of our unit, we changed the name several years ago to Firearms Training and Tactics. So, in the old days, we used to just teach people how to shoot, right? So we made them really accurate, but the responsibilities of a modern-day police officer are so much greater. We really wanted to expand into the thought process, decision-making, and expand the abilities of our people to address the varying situations that they find themselves in on a regular basis. So everything that goes into that, we've expanded what we do, and so we try to make the best decision-makers as we can with both our recruits and our veteran officers.
Let's talk a little bit about de-escalation, this term that we're kicking around today. What are some of the things you're teaching officers about how to proceed when faced with what might be a potentially violent situation?
So one of the biggest things that we want to impart with them is that they need to stay calm in a chaotic situation. So we're teaching around techniques to allow them to remain calm and stay within themselves and not get caught up in the circumstances.
How do you do that?
Human beings are hardwired to win, right? So in some kind of a conflict, we have an overwhelming need to win. And what we're teaching around is it's not about winning or losing. It's about being able to resolve the situation with as least amount of force as you can. So One of the big things that we talk about and impart in them is communication. And that's one of the hardest things over the last few years, at least it seems, to get people to make good communication. And so we invest a huge amount of the 1,100 plus hours in the training academy in communication, being able to talk and interact with other human beings.
Even other human beings who are excited and yelling and maybe a little emotional, and trying to calm them down, I imagine, in a moment like that, or at least communicate effectively somehow?
Correct. We all have a fight or flight center in our brain that perceives danger and threat and things like that. And for a long, long time, police science focused on the people that we deal with in reference to that, and we fail to realize that we're human beings as well, and we also have that center in our brain. Mm-hmm. So a lot of time is spent on techniques to allow the police officer to make good decisions, right? So if fight or flight takes over, I'm in survival mode, but if I can shortcut that and stay in the smart part of my brain, then I have options and I just can continue to cycle through those and come up with the best solution to the problem.
I assume some officers are better at that than others.
Yeah. So everybody processes information differently. And, you know, our job as trainers is to get everybody to a standard and then take them beyond that in reference to their ability levels.
You know, I assume you do this training with both recruits and with veterans who've been on the force for any number of years?
We do, yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm responsible for 120 hours. My team and I are responsible for 120 hours of recruit training. And then police officers come in annually for continuing education. So we hit both sides of it.
Why is it so important that this training happen, you know, consistently throughout a law enforcement officer's career?
It's that principle, if you don't attend to it, it deteriorates, right? So as with anything, relationships, your health, if you pay attention to it and attend to it on a regular basis, you stay fit, you stay at a high level of performance. And for police officers, they stay current with what's actually going on in society.
How long has de-escalation training been around? I mean, police departments didn't always have this kind of training, I think.
So the term de-escalation came in around 2014, kind of the same time as the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson. But de-escalation, at its essence, what it really is, has been around. I've been in law enforcement almost 40 years. It's it's been there that entire time, the ability to communicate with other human beings, and have them understand and get them to calm down. Because generally speaking, when somebody calls 911, their life is out of their normal equilibrium, right? We have a left shoulder and a right shoulder on the road, and as long as we stay somewhere off the shoulder, we're living okay. And when people run off the road, that's when they call 911 and ask for somebody to come and help them. So,
you know, what are some of the things, you know, that police might say to suspects, sergeant, to begin to de-escalate a situation that's taking place?
So the first thing we want them to do is generally speaking, to calm down, right? And me asking you to calm down looks different than me at arm's length or even closer versus me at 10 or 15 feet, right? So we all have this hardwired reaction in our brains that as something threatening closes distance, the threat level goes up and I get more anxious. So we try to teach folks, initially at least, our police officers, when they're approaching somebody, you know, start the communication from as far away as you can. Don't press in if you feel like that person's going to be agitated or show signs of becoming agitated when you get closer to them.
That's a real basic thing, but it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and we're so committed to it, we've incorporated it into our firearms training qualification course, right? So police officers are required to communicate with an inanimate object, being the target downrange, the entire time they're firing a qualification course for us. So the thinking is if it's like forming any kind of good habit. If you do it repeatedly, you'll do it automatically, even under high stress.
What else might you tell them about those moments when you encounter someone who's really emotional and careening a little bit?
It's been true throughout my career. I've always had a trainer telling me, treat as much as you possibly can that person as you would want a family member or somebody close to you to be treated, right? So we see people at their worst on a regular basis. And if you can think about you at your worst or the most stressed you've ever been, how would you want somebody to treat you? And that's how we communicate it with our police officers.
Yeah, how often does your average police officer in Kansas City find themselves in a situation where they might be considering a potentially lethal use of force?
So it's kind of a multifaceted question. So we have a lot of police officers who are assigned to the patrol bureau, which means they're in a police car answering calls and things like that. I would say on a daily basis, we have, without a doubt on a daily basis, we have police officers that are facing the potential to use up to and including deadly force. And right,
every day. Yeah.
And they're cycling through those decisions moment to moment. We're teaching around that during our in-service training this year, and we're trying to quantify those time variables where if you encounter somebody from a further distance, it gives you more time to make a decision, right? You have more options, and the closer you get, the less options you have, and then your decision really comes down to, at the end of it, depending on distance and a whole lot of other factors, whether you're going to use force or not. So again, going back to the de-escalation question, we try to program them to encounter potentially dangerous situations from as far away as they can, which opens up a ton of choices and decisions versus encountering it from up close. You've seen police videos before where the action or whatever encounter starts from way too close, and at that distance, our options are completely limited, right?
You know, tell us about this idea of fluid intelligence and how every interaction is different. What is fluid intelligence?
So we teach around fluid intelligence. We've been talking about it again this year in service. So it's the ability to remain in the moment, right, and understand that there's constantly options. It's kind of funny. So the folks that are under 35, especially folks that are under 20, fluid intelligence is part of what helps you develop your brain. I have three adult children, and I watched that as they were growing up. Now I have two grandchildren, and to watch how their brains work and how they work things out and how they are able to figure stuff out a lot quicker. And the example I use is when I was in my 20s, I went to my parents' house and my mom grabbed me by the hand and drug me into the living room and said, "You got to help me do something with this." And they had a VCR and they had just plugged it into the TV and it was flashing 12 o'clock. And I took a deep breath and I go, "Okay, I got this." And within 5 minutes, I had all of their programs and the clock was right and everything was fine. My mom hugged me and said that she was so proud she sent me to college and I was a genius. Fast forward about a few years, we changed Wi-Fi in our house, right? And the TV wasn't working and nothing was working. My adult daughter walks in and my wife grabs her and goes, "You got to do something with this." She literally grabbed her cell phone, punched a button. You know, within 30 seconds, everything was working perfectly. And she goes, "There you go." My wife hugged her and said, "You're a genius. I'm so glad we sent you to college. Thank you so much." So the ability to adapt to new and varying inputs is that fluid intelligence. As we age, that starts to decline. But there's some research out there that would suggest that police officers, because of the nature of our jobs, we can extend that fluid intelligence, the continuing evolution of that, a little bit longer than the average person, because we have jobs that require us, if we embrace it, to look for new solutions to old problems.
Following a script is not always an option here, it doesn't
Correct.
Sound like.
We like police officers that are thinkers. We want you to think, not just react.
You know, how do you train police here in Kansas City, Sergeant, on what kind of force is warranted in any given situation?
So the principle that we teach about is reasonableness, right? So Graham Conner was a Supreme Court decision that was brought out in 1989. I'm sure the Supreme Court is looking for cases for them to hear that would maybe modify it or add to that. It just hasn't happened yet. But the basics of that is that it's just the underlying principle is you need to be reasonable in all your interactions with the public, right? And so that can be use of force. It can be, you know, driving on the road and how you treat somebody when you stop them for a traffic ticket. So interlaced in all of our training is that principle of reasonableness. We need to be reasonable.
You approach Kansas City University to actually study deep breathing and its effect on officer training. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at there, Sergeant?
Sure. So we understood for years that breathing helped people make good decisions, and we've trained around it pretty specifically since about 2015. I was looking for a research partner. We did some research around what is referred to as the badge study back in 2011 and 2012. Had a good reaction nationally with law enforcement agencies. So we were, and I'm proud to say Kansas City, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department has embraced research for years. We've done a lot and partnered with people. So I was looking for somebody to partner with to get that academic accreditation and validity. I was lucky enough to find Dr. Sarah Getch from Kansas City University, who got really interested in how we do training and has been up to the academy a whole bunch. And we talked to her about this breathing piece, and we knew a little bit, but, you know, she's a doctor of psychology, much more in tune to what's going on with that. And we were able to design a study. And what it is we took a control group that we just, on a day handgun qualification course, we just took their raw scores. And then on the experimental group, we had them do some visualization and a deep breathing exercise, something we're calling right now core focused breathing. So it's diaphragmatic breathing down in the belly.
Right.
And if you watch an NFL game, if they focus on the linemen, they're doing diaphragmatic breathing. They're trying to calm themselves down and ready themselves for the next play. Mm-hmm. Same thing with police officers. So we had a experimental group do the diaphragmatic breathing, and we're still crunching numbers, but the results are, to me, somewhat astounding. So some of the preliminary differences are 10% difference or 10-point difference in scores. Mm-hmm. But for me, the big thing that I wanted to look at was the difference between people failing and succeeding, and it's on a factor of 10 to 1 at this point. So,
No kidding.
You know, and if you look at it as just, were you just trying to get people to shoot better and not fail? That's not the purpose of what this is. we think this is going to carry over into all kinds of things, both on and off duty for police officers and maybe even for the average person. If you can breathe and stay in the prefrontal cortex and make good decisions, you have a lot more decisions available to you.
Maybe
we don't have so many bad outcomes, right? So maybe we make good decisions.
And your department still has those simulation exercises with the video screen where an officer reacts to what's being projected on a screen as to whether to use force or not. That still happens too, right?
We do, yeah. Our particular one's called the Virtua Machine. We just did an update with some new software and hardware in reference to it. And it's an invaluable tool for decision making. And most of those scenarios are around uses of force, but it's adaptable enough that we can do virtually anything with it. And we're looking at new technology as well that doesn't even require you to be in a room with a big projector and all the rest of it. You actually move around in a normal environment.
Well, that's Sergeant Ward Smith, teaches firearms training with the Kansas City Police Department. And I hope you'll come back and tell us more about breathing if those numbers continue to show what you think they're going to show, if there's a potential breakthrough there in terms of how police begin to think about the importance of that going forward.
Yeah, I'd be happy to come back. And I know that Dr. Goetsch would love to come
in.
And we could come in and talk to you about it. We're still crunching numbers and trying to come up and quantify what we actually found on it, but literally we're talking to each other several times every day. Everybody that was involved in it, super excited.
Sergeant Ward Smith with the Kansas City Police. Sergeant, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.